to the faculty meeting to meet with us about this article and his response. And then I went to the area superintendent, Sam Haywood, and started pressuring him to make this happen. And it took on this sort of surreal aspect to it, where negotiations were taking place between me and Sam, and and I was threatening him, you know, that, you know, we're going to go to the newspapers if you don't, you know, we can write things as well as other people can, letters to the editor and other responses, and this was, my anger was clearly apparent to him, this went on for about 10 days, and these were not nice conversations at all. And I'll never forget one day I was taught in a trailer, and he actually knocked on my door in the middle of class, and he said, "I need to talk to you." And we stepped outside in the rain. He's in a kind of trench coat on. It was something out of some espionage novel. And he's standing there, and he said, "The superintendent will come tomorrow afternoon after school, and we'll call." So we ended up getting the superintendent. We came down here, and Jay Robinson came in. This whole place was packed, cafeteria, and so we wanted a statement from him. He didn't understand our feelings, and so he starts off by saying that he was, I don't know if you've ever heard Jay Robinson, but he came from the mountains of North Carolina, and he had this sort of mountain nasal twang. And he said, "We're going to try to address these concerns," and all this sort of stuff. And so we were all sitting there just in disbelief. And after about 15 or 20 minutes of him rambling on like this, you know, attempting to say nothing in effect, I stood up and I said to him explained to him that we were outraged by his lack of defense of one of his 11 high schools, and that the impression left in the community is that West Charlotte does not care about its white students. And went on from there, you know, and he said, "Well, now I've learned that when it comes to the media, the best thing to do is not to respond." And that's when my anger was really apparent. And I said to him that may be good for you, but you need to respond for us now. And sure enough, at the next school board meeting, he made a public statement to that effect, and that West Charlotte did care about all the students, and on and on and on, that sort of thing. But there was a case where we were fighting the battle, not just in the white community, not just with the media, but with our own leadership in the school system. You know, and it gave, and that was, you know, one instance where I learned that separate can never be equal. It just, human nature does not allow it to be equal. And then when all that was over, I remember having this need to tell somebody who could understand it. And so I called Dick Spangler and asked if I could come over that evening and talk to him. Now at this point, Dick Spangler was no longer chair of the school board, but he was only a few months or a half a year away from being main president of the North Carolina university system. So he was still obviously very interested in everything and in West Charlotte, and because, you know, his daughter was there. But anyway, we sat up one night and I told him the story, and there were a lot of other ramifications to all the characters involved in this story that are not important now. But it was really like living some sort of like novel, you know, because you had all these different people whose self-interest, you know, pulled the situation in different directions. That was just one of maybe four or five really significant battles that I personally fought in my time there. I mean, I was threatened with a lawsuit by the principal at Myers Park High School.
How did that come about?
Well, that's...
And you don't feel...
Well, it makes no difference at this point, but it just shows how things like this can get out of hand. Mm-hmm. And also it deals with athletics, mm-hmm. which might be of interest to you. I mean, this is a pretty sort of localized anecdote, but when the soccer program at West Shaw was starting to develop and we were starting to win, we were able to challenge East Mecklenburg and Myers Park and play them competitively. And so one year we had a pretty good team. We weren't as good as they were. Let's say Myers Park, who was the strongest team that year, and it like was ranked like second in the state and all this sort of thing as the season was progressing. But we had a student on the team who was from Ethiopia, and he was a substitute, didn't play very much. Great guy. Actually, his father was a pilot in the Ethiopian... I don't think he was in the Air Force. I think he was like for the Ethiopian commercial airline system or something, I believe. Well, anyway, the father and the family were sort of supporters of Haile Selassie, and when Selassie was sort of ousted from power, then that family was on the outs. And this boy and his brother, who both ended up at West Charlotte, were actually arrested and detained and as sort of political prisoners, because they were part of the opposition for a while, and they were actually tortured. And the father, at some point, when they were, I guess, somehow released, sort of spirited them out of the country, flew them out, and they ended up somehow in Charlotte and West Charlotte. There was a human interest story done in the Observer about this this student, and it mentioned that he played soccer and that sort of thing. Now, we did not have, at that time, many sort of foreign-born players on the team at West Charlotte. But the Myers Park coach did, because they had the English as a second language program, and he got a lot of players that way. Anyway, Frank Ponce, who was the coach, and who recently died of a heart attack, and he was beloved by his players and students at Myers Park, saw the article, and because of some information in the article, realized that this kid must have been ineligible to play. So Frank, at the end of the season, toward the end of the season, sort of turned us in. And it turned out that, yes, in fact, the kid was ineligible to play. And the reason was that he had not been in attendance for 80% of the school days of the previous year. It's, you know, just one of these sort of obscure rules that the statewide sort of athletics association has. And it's to prevent kids from being recruited from one school to another and playing immediately. Now we didn't know that, and our athletics director, who was supposed to check the eligibility of all the players on all the teams, he didn't catch it, because the homeroom teacher, this kid was never absent. So the homeroom teacher subtracted zero absences from 180 days by mistake. It turned out this kid was only in school one semester the previous year, so she sort of should have subtracted zero from 90. And 90 was not enough days to be in attendance to be eligible to participate the following season. So we, you know, of course, pointed all this out, and so we had to forfeit then all of our wins for that season. And the kid was then ineligible to play and all that sort of thing. Well, that made some of our parents mad who lived in Myers Park, because they knew that there were players on the Myers Park team who had falsified their addresses to go to Myers Park and not to West Charlotte. And they lived on the same street, for goodness sakes. It turns out that when we played Myers Park at the end of that season, and this may have been actually in the conference, maybe in the conference tournament at the end of the season, we lost to Myers Park 4-1, and everyone who scored, every goal scored against us was scored by a player who was supposed to be going to West Charlotte. Well, anyway, we pointed, me and this other coach at that time, learned that two of the students, especially from what our parents had told us, were supposed to be at West Charlotte, and in fact, we had found out through our sources, a mole in the attendance office at Myers Park, that in fact their records showed that they were living in the West Charlotte district and should have gone to West Charlotte. And so so we said to them, about them, what was said to us, that either they knew or they should have known. So anyway, we sent that up through through the chain of command up to the superintendent. And it was at that point that the principal at Myers Park then threatened me with a lawsuit for libel. And got a letter from his lawyer and the whole thing, all of that. But there was a lot more going on with that principal too. None of this is usually just about what it appears. He was having a hard time because of some other things he was doing at the school or going on at the school, and I'm sure he didn't think he could handle one more, negative mark. To make a long story short, nothing was ever done about the Myers Park ineligible players. They were allowed to continue playing for the rest of the season. They beat us and they went on into the state playoffs and did well. The superintendent, again, it was Jay Robinson at that time, I am sure, did not want the story of Myers Park having to forfeit games because white kids were avoiding busting to West Charlotte to get into the media. That was just, wasn't worth whatever justice there may have been to, to those of us that involved in West Charlotte soccer. Of course, we thought, couldn't see that big picture at that time. And then one of the interesting things is that the following year, sure enough, one of those players came to West Charlotte and played soccer for us. Another player graduated. He was player of the year in the conference. His younger brother, who was not as good a player, applied for a board-approved transfer to Myers Park. And I'm told that I saw that part of the reason was that his mother could not handle the psychological stress of her son going to West Charlotte. And they approved it. It turns out that they were related to someone on the school board. So, but again, those are all sort of the battles for respect, and there again played out in the media to a certain degree, and not, and it's just that constant sort of fighting and sense of outrage and that sort of thing. There were other things that you would see, being in a school in a minority neighborhood. There would be a bond referendum for school improvements in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, and we'd be told that a new science building in West Charlotte was, third on the list when it was sort of advertised to the community, and especially to the black community, and then the bond referendum would pass, and the building would never be built because, there were cost overruns down at South Mech, and all that sort of thing, and
it sounds like, the way you're telling it, I'm misinterpreting that you kind of joyful.
I did somewhat. I don't think I never sort of created a battle in order to try to win one. I was never that savvy a politician or a leader, You know, those. I was involved with one sort of like, I mean, not a battle, but with a project where, just in our interactions with, actually, the editor of the Observer, we sort of made it a battle, something a battle, so that we would, so that they would have to choose, you know, what side they were going to be on. But I got in. You're right to a certain degree, because later, at the end of my teaching career, I got real involved in educational reform issues. And I actually wrote a couple op-ed pieces in the Observer. One just blasted the career development program in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. That's a whole other story. But and got involved for within the school system for educational reform issues for teacher sort of respect for teachers, you know, both within and outside the school system.
Why did you stop teaching?
I think it was just sort of, I was ready to do something different at that time. I wasn't burned out really, but the main reason I think was that I'd done it for 12 or 13 years, if you include getting certified. And I guess there were just other things I wanted to do. You know, and I sort of felt like what my son said to me when he came to Davidson as a freshman and found himself to be so much more liberal than his hallmates and all. He said, you know, I could argue with them all day long about why they should be less homophobic and more open-minded or interested in diversity and that sort of thing. He said, but I didn't come here to fight those battles. And so at some point, you know, it wasn't my calling to fight those battles. It just wasn't. They were byproducts of my main work, you know, teaching there. Other things, though, sort, you know, when you, then once you sort of have that sort of realization, then other things start really sort of aggravating me. The system was imposing their, quote, career development program. It was basically the school system's merit pay program, which the state legislature was demanding from school systems. And it was just opposite of my view of teaching and education and learning and all that. And I realized that I really didn't sort of really didn't fit into the at least what downtown wanted, and so I didn't want to have to, you know, fight a whole new set of battles in that sense. But also I wanted to do something different.
Well, this has really been wonderful. I so much appreciate you taking talk to me about this. Is there anything else about West Charlotte or teaching or integration that you think is important to say that we haven't talked about?
Well, one thing that strikes me is the connection of West Charlotte to Davidson and to other private schools in Charlotte. Most people would not suspect that so many West Charlotte students went on to Davidson College. There was actually a tradition of students coming from West Charlotte to Davidson. Every year there would be 2, 3, 4, 5 who would come. The reason that's significant is that you do have this very traditional, overwhelmingly white school, college, Davidson, you know, being impressed with these students. And those students really succeeding at Davidson. Then people also may not realize how many students went back and forth in Charlotte among or between West Charlotte and the private schools there. We always had a fair number who came to West Charlotte from private schools for various reasons. we had a smaller number who would leave West Charlotte and go to a private school. That actually didn't happen very much. But I see these schools as all being part of a larger system. I think there's a role for all of them. I mean, I went to private schools my whole life, but ended up teaching in a public school. I think private schools are a necessity for no other reason than to give parents a choice. And it's better for them to be able to take their children from a school at which they're unhappy to some other school than to have those children and parents have to stay in that school and just and build up resentment. And I think that some parents just have a very low tolerance for people who were different, for unfamiliar situations. And although it's easy for us to say, oh, they should be different, you know, I mean, people are different. I didn't see West Charlotte in competition with the private schools, although we really were, because our parents who lived in Eastover and Myers Park and Cotswold could afford to send their kids to private school. So I guess I would hope that people would not see these sort of inherent conflicts so much or focus on them, but see this larger picture of what's best for society and of course for the students, I mean, individually. It's not shocking that students from West Charlotte could go to a school like Davidson and be happy and do well, both black and white. It's not shocking that kids could come from private schools in privileged areas in South Mecklenburg County and go to West Charlotte and be happy and learn. That can happen. So that's one thing that struck me about West Charlotte. The other thing is just some of the poignant images I remember of the black teachers and administrators who were at West Charlotte. Because it was, you know, like the black high school before it was the flagship school for integration. And it was very difficult for them to see what had happened to their school. They were very proud of their school before integration. There was a big sacrifice on their part to allow white kids to come to their school. For one thing, they had less control over how the school was run and that sort of thing. There was a loss of ownership to a large degree because so many decisions were being made downtown for political reasons, by white people mainly. One of the teachers told me one time that, and by the way, I ran into his daughter, whom I taught yesterday out here. She has two little children now. But one of the black teachers told me that, you know, before integration, we didn't have these discipline problems. You know, and teachers commanded a lot of respect at that school by the students and by the community before integration. There was an erosion of that, as there was with discipline after integration. The Alumni Association is an alumni association, which is unusual for a public high school. It's only like one of two or three across the country that is a quote national alumni association. People pay dues and all that stuff. They give money every year to the PTSA fund drive. Those are the classes before integration, for the most part. So those are glimpses that white folks will never see. Again, probably. I mean, unless you've actually worked shoulder to shoulder with black folks, especially people who had gone to West Charlotte as students, you don't sort of get glimpses like that into their pride in the school. One of the most poignant things I saw was when the football team lost in the finals of the state playoffs in Rockingham to a high school down there, and that was in the, I guess that was the late 70s. That was the first time West Charlotte had made it to the finals since integration. West Charlotte had won the state football championship before integration, so they had won sort of the competition among black schools. But this was going to be the year they were going to win the whole thing. And they lost. And the disappointment was so much greater than just losing a football game. You know, they, for a lot of those alumni, especially the football playing alumni and the teachers, it was extremely disappointing. And I don't think that some of them and Rudy Abrams, who was the head coach at that time at West Charlotte, and who was black, ever really got over it. And was only a couple years later, Rudy left West Charlotte, went to Gardiner, and then he went on to coach at college. And then after that, West Charlotte had white head coaches, I suppose, so the black image wouldn't be so apparent. And West Charlotte has won the state football championship. But it was so much more important then, so close to integration, than it was when they finally won it in the mid-80s or something. And winning it with a black coach was much more meaningful than winning it with a white coach.
Well, how do you think, I mean, you say that these are glimpses that most white folks don't have a chance to see. These are things that most white folks never encounter, never get a chance to imagine. How is it, I don't know if I ask, not how it's changed you, but what does it mean to you that you didn't have a chance to see some of these things?
Well, it was a privilege, of course. I realized that. At the same time, I'm very aware that on most issues, I really don't know what black people are thinking about them. It's made me aware of that. When white people work with black people and are on a daily basis, you know, people, they don't say to each other what they would say when they go home, you know, or with, you know, their closest friends who are the same race. I mean, and that's fine, and that's human nature. But then there's also feelings that aren't expressed, too. And so, it's not that it makes me distrustful. It's not a matter of distrust. It's just a matter of, you know, let's be careful before we leap to certain conclusions. You know, let's be really sure that everybody's on board with this. You know, just because they're not protesting or, you know, too much or voicing objections or, you know, or whatever, you know, doesn't mean that they're really on board with this. So I think that's part of it. Part of it is just are just sort of glimpses into the human heart, too. The athletics director during that championship season at West Charlotte was named Ernest Cherry. He was a wonderful fella and black. And he died a couple years after that. I don't think he ever got over that loss. He was the athletics director when we had to forfeit those soccer matches, and he felt terrible about that. It still wasn't his fault, But I think that he felt he had something to prove. You know, he had increased pressure. And he probably had to be perfect. And I think he died of a broken heart to a large degree. And then tragically, his son, who went to West Charlotte and was in my homeroom class, died in a car accident when he was like a junior. And that was extremely sad to go to that funeral. So a lot of these are just, you know, they're glimpses into the human heart that we all have, everyone has at different times in their lives. And, you know, I mean, they're privileges when you see them. They're painful sometimes, and sometimes they're just great. I remember one time Bill McMillan, the principal, would often at that, in those years, this is the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s, the West Charlotte teachers would often sort of go out for a beer after work on Friday afternoons. Teachers don't do much socializing, believe it or not. Well, for one thing, they don't have much money to do, spend like other people do, going out to dinner and that sort of thing. But because we had some teachers who had some pizzazz to them and who were young, this sort of thing got started, and then Bill McMillan, sometimes was the principal, would go with us, and he was a lot of fun and all. And then a couple times we went, we would have like staff parties or like a Christmas party or something, over in the Omega Clubhouse. And you may know that the Omegas are the National Black Fraternity. And that's, anyway, this place is off of, I guess it's off of Graham Street. We're on Graham Street, actually. It's a simple sort of building. It looks like it would be a fraternity clubhouse. But, you know, unlike white fraternities, those relationships are just getting started at graduation from college. I mean, the Omegas were, who were at, and there were quite a few at West Charlotte, were great. And anyway, we would go over there, and they had a jukebox, and we would dance, and we just had a great time. And, you know, there's sort of a glimpse into the sort of the, you know, the other side of the tracks that I would never have had otherwise. And they really enjoyed having us, and they were proud because it was on their home turf. And they were hosting this for us, you know, and it was the greatest thing to build some trust and all. And so that was one of the really sort of happy glimpses, you know. Of course, the achievement of individual students was were always something we all celebrated in and took delight in. And I think that all the teachers, white as well as black, really took pride in the accomplishments of our black students. Really did. I mean, nobody wanted those students to achieve more than we did. I'm always sort of mystified when I read in the paper about studies that say that or imply that white teachers aren't that interested in their black students. I mean, my goodness, we value them so much. I mean, especially bright students, you know. Those were just some of the great times. The West Charlotte band was unbelievable. The cheerleaders were unbelievable. Again, that sort of black culture was a lot more earthy and risque is not the right word, but anyway, their dancing and their cheers and their moves and all were a lot more sexual than you would see and that would be allowed at other schools. And the band, you know, was more famous for its dancing than its playing. And, you know, another accomplishment was really just the improvement in the band. When West Charlotte went down to Rockingham to play that evening, we played at this high school stadium that was a huge stadium. I don't know how many it's had, maybe 7,000 or 8,000. And at halftime, the Rockingham band comes out. Well, their band is just decked out, beautiful uniforms. There's like 100 of them. they're extremely accomplished musicians and so disciplined. They do all these, you could tell, competitions, and they had this, even when they would sort of warm up first, and that was a whole routine to watch, and then they would, they did these, you know, formations and moves, and they were shooting off fireworks from inside these formations, and unbelievable, you know. And then the West Charlotte band comes out. They're wearing t-shirts and whatever pants they could, and tennis shoes. I don't think they even had hats. It's, you know, probably 35 kids at the most. Only maybe 5 are white. They come out, line up across the field, and just play one song, and it's, or two songs, and they just sort of rocked. You know, how they would play, and they played sort of this just funky sort of rhythm and all. The drums were good, but you couldn't hear anything else. And it was just so embarrassing. And it'd be, and for me, it didn't bother me that much. But I could, I mean, you know, for the black parents and administrators, it's, you know, what can you, it's just embarrassing. And so after that, West Charlotte got in, recruited a band director. He was a fabulous guy named Davenport. And he came to West Charlotte, and he transformed the marching band. And then they also shook some money loose from downtown and bought uniforms for the West Charlotte band. And Davenport then created this band that was one of the largest of the high schools in the city. The musicianship really increased a lot, but they had this routine, and they danced, and it was in the tradition of the black college bands. And they were fabulous, just fabulous after that. And even though it would be black, you know, sort of the black style, it was good, and people loved it. You didn't have to apologize for it at all. And then it was a big thing, and my son, my older boy, loved the West Charlotte band. And in fifth grade, he took up the saxophone just so he could be able to play in the West Charlotte band when he got there as a 10th grader, which he did. So he looked forward to that for 4 or 5 years. And Davenport, by the way, created a wonderful jazz band at West Charlotte. It was just beloved by the students, and he retired a few years ago. And actually, he and my son Jeremy, who came to Davison, became very close friends. And but he was wonderful guy. He was friends with Dizzy Gillespie and some of the black, famous black musicians from up north and all that, and had wonderful stories to tell for the kids in the jazz band and all. But there you saw, you see, you had the sense of it's getting better. You know, we're doing something here. So anyway, those are sort of some of the things that it means to be able to be a part of that, And, you know, finally, you know, you realize that the people who don't want diversity are the ones who are missing out. Life is so much more rich because of diversity. And, you know, we finally got to the point of West Charlotte where, at least I would say, you know, well, those white folks who don't want to come to West Charlotte, you know, that's their problem. It's not our problem. They're the ones who are missing out.
Good note to close.
This is an interviewer's note that as part of his agreement to give this interview to the university, Mr. Tarr requests that the story which he told about the lawsuit related to soccer players not be used for publication.